Hello, everybody, and welcome to Kentucky Ag Matters, a podcast designed to inform and educate both producers and consumers about all matters affecting agriculture. Special thanks to WKDZ, your Ag Edge Network, for their help in bringing you this show. On this week's show, David, Jay, and Vicki will sit down and visit with Dr. Andy Bailey, Extension Dark Tobacco Specialist for University of Kentucky and University of Tennessee, to discuss tobacco transplant production in the greenhouse. Our weekly topic will be tobacco production and managing high input prices. And as always, we'll wrap things up with a timely tip. Thanks so much for joining us. We hope you enjoy the show. Well, hello, everybody.
Hey, Jay.
Hey, Jay.
Vicki, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. I'm loving this sunshine.
Isn't it nice?
Yes.
The rain we had over the weekend was it was really the kind of rain we need this time of the year. It wasn't storms. There was a lot of it, but it came at a slow enough pace that it didn't wash the world away in the process. So
yeah, it was a little damp. It was a little damp, though.
It was. I had to drive to Lexington actually on Sunday, and it was coming down at a pretty good clip when I was driving.
Yeah, Sunday evening especially, it was a little heavier than it had been throughout the day. So I think we had some winds sometime through the night to go along with that. And I woke up to a tornado watch in Christian County, thankfully we had no big damage or anything to really be concerned about. So this week's guest, Dr. Andy Bailey. Andy, good morning.
Good morning.
How's everything going with you?
Good, Jay. Good to see y'all. Good to be with y'all today.
Good. Glad to have you. Andy's going to talk this week with us about greenhouse production and some of those topics. But Andy, if you want to, just start off, tell a little bit about yourself and how long you've been with the University of Kentucky.
Sure. I've been with the University of Kentucky for 20 years this year. I started back in 2002 as a cooperative agreement between the University of Tennessee and the University of Kentucky to serve dark tobacco growers in this area, which is about a 24-county area that covers Tennessee and Kentucky, basically north of Nashville to Owensboro, and as west as Mayfield, and then as far east as almost to Bowling Green. And so that's kind of the area I serve. I'm stationed out of the Princeton Research Station, and so I've been there for 20 years, made my family there, and that's where we are.
That's so awesome. We're glad to have you here. Most people know by now there's not a Princeton Research Station per se. Of course, was damaged by the December 10th tornadoes, and I guess like a lot of folks, you're probably working out of a home office for the time being, or?
We are trucks and home office, hopefully get some temporary offices sometime in May, but basically just a lot of still cleaning up debris in fields and pastures there as we can. And this time of the year, we're doing a lot of meetings, of course. Grower meetings hadn't slowed down at all. So between those, we're a lot of storm cleanup and planning for rebuilding. We are going to rebuild this station, and so we're planning on building tobacco barns back already. In fact, some of the tobacco barns we had there that we lost will be some of the first structures, I think, that will go back right behind our shop building and equipment storage. We'll see some tobacco barns probably go up. Our dark-fired barn will be exactly the same as it was in the same place, and so we're excited about that and are ready to see some things going up and get past cleanup.
That's awesome. I know it's a slow process. There in Hopkins County, we've had quite a bit of damage as well. A lot of small producers affected, but affected in a great way, so I can appreciate that. But you're talking about working out of your truck. I've worked with you for a lot of years, all those 20 years, as a matter of fact, and there's a lot of the times of the year you spend it working out of the truck and always have, so that's something you probably adapted to pretty quick.
Yeah, no big problem there. Of course, the last 2 years we've been working out of our homes a little bit anyway with COVID and the pandemic, so that's kind of gotten us acclimated, but it is a very strange situation there, and we're just, like I said, we're all looking forward to having a place to go to the research station again.
Absolutely. And the good news is that will come. Emails from our dean have reinforced that here lately, and I think it's nice to know that process and that facility will be something that will be there to help producers for years and years to come.
Yeah, so it'll be probably a 3-year process, we're thinking, but we are anxious to get to that point.
Sounds good. Well, we're going to talk about greenhouse tobacco production and to those 24 counties that you help serve specifically. it's the hot topic right now. Folks are getting everything ready or are already in their plant, in their houses, and have trays seeded and whatnot. So just kind of start from the top. This is a process that a lot of folks need to know about, because I've always felt like that strong foundation for good production in the field started with a good, healthy transplant.
That's right.
The greenhouse is definitely where we start that process.
That's right. You know, this time of the year in Kentucky, West Kentucky, about 1st of March through March 15th is ideal time for seeding. So we're right in the middle of that, or at the beginning of that. Most growers would like to have plants ready, if the field is ready, by the 1st of May. So it's about an 8-week process that we're starting on right now. And generally, for most growers, the 15th of March is still plenty of time to get plants ready by the end of that first week of May. But we want to start clean for sure. Right? Greenhouse has been sitting there since last spring or early last summer, and nothing's going on in it. So there's a cleanup process. We want to start clean for sure. There's a lot of it can be a real hotbed for diseases in that greenhouse situation, and so we want to start clean. I've had some questions. I get questions every year about water source. If you think about well water versus municipal water, it's always a lot better to use municipal water sources if you can. Although well water sources can work, but you have to get them tested. And University of Kentucky has got a means of testing well water for its usability in tobacco float beds. And so some of the main things we look at are the pH of the water. It needs to be somewhere between 6 and 7.5. The alkalinity in that water, in other words, how well it can buffer when you add fertilizer, how well it can buffer against a drop in that pH without affecting plant growth. And so so those are a couple of things that we look at a lot. But if you got if you have a well water source you hadn't used before, the main thing I would just encourage growers to have that tested. And you can bring a quart water sample into the extension office. It'll be sent to Lexington, but there's a specific test that can be done for float water. But any question about that, it's if you have the option, it's always safer. I've never seen a municipal water source that really wouldn't work for tobacco float beds, but we have had some well water sources that weren't suitable.
If they do need to get a water sample, I mean, you know, there's a method for getting a good water sample, just like there is getting a good soil sample or anything else. So, I mean, is there a particular way they need to take that sample, or, you know?
Yeah, we like to let that, when they go to the water source, let that water run for at least 30 seconds, because there'll be some things that come out of that hydrate, there that may not be, suitable for the sample. So run at least 30 seconds, if not a couple of minutes. A quart sample is usually what we get on these float water tests sent off, and then you'll get a lot of data back. But that's usually what I would.
The container that they use, just make sure that's clean.
It's got to be a clean. Yeah, it needs to be a clean container.
Does it need to be glass, or does it need to be plastic?
No, we've used Nalgene plastic type bottle. As long as it's clean, I think it's fine. I'm not aware that that the material that the sample's taken makes a big difference on that, as long as it's clean.
Yeah. Okay. Would you recommend, Andy, for those folks that are using a well water, that they go ahead and do that every year just to stay on top of
what's going on with the environment? Probably a good idea. These sources in some of these water veins, I understand, can change some. It's probably a good idea to do that. Usually, if they the ones that we've had that we've seen and had tested, if it's really just bad, shouldn't go in a float bed, then that's usually, it doesn't change a whole lot.
Yeah, it's probably not going to get any better.
Over time. It won't get any better. But the ones that are suitable, you may want to test those every year just to make sure they're still, especially if they were kind of marginal on those, some of the values there on the, like I said, pH 6 to 7.5. It'll give you an alkalinity rating in there, which should fall between 50 and 100 on alkalinity. And so if it's marginal there one way or the other, it's probably a good idea to have that tested the next year too. And, alkalinity, that's the main three things, pH, alkalinity, and calcium content. You can have some alkalinity problems, but if you got enough calcium, it can offset that. And so if you have say, high alkalinity that's over 150 or 175, and your calcium is less than about 50, there's some remediation measures that we got a publication about that back when float beds first started back in the mid-90s. That was written, Gary Palmer and Bob Pierce actually wrote that. And you can remediate some of these acidification problems or some of these alkalinity problems by adding some acid, just virgin battery acid, sulfuric acid.
Sulfuric acid was what I've been familiar with using in the past.
Yeah, that can go in to help that. Again, if your alkalinity ends up being over about 150 or 175 and your calcium is below about 40 or 50, that's when we have to use acid. But if calcium is well above 50 and you got high alkalinity, it can offset that and it still be okay, assuming your pH is good.
Sounds good.
Just gotta have that tested if you're not sure about the well water.
Just quickly, is there a fee for this water test?
It seemed like a water test was maybe $25.
I think that's right. Yeah. It's similar to a solid to a manure sample.
Yeah. I think that's right.
$25 well spent though.
That's right. Yeah, there can be some major problems with a bad water source if you don't know what you're getting into. So
that's right.
$25 is a real pretty cheap insurance against that.
I agree.
Yep. Sounds good. Well, we've got that water tested. What's the next step producers need to be
thinking about? So once they're comfortable about the water, of course, you want to make sure you're using all new plastic in these beds. Of course, most of these float beds have got a layer. They've got maybe sand or gravel or fine gravel underneath in the bed of them, in the bottom of them, and then they're going to be maybe a landscape fabric to protect the plastic layer. Of course, the plastic, these are basically, it's kind of a semi-hydroponic situation. You've got a soilless media in these trays. They're styrofoam trays. They're floating on water. And on a bed of water anywhere from 4 to 6 inches deep. And so, but you want to have that plastic, new plastic every year, because there can be a lot of things, especially Pythium, that can reside on that plastic if you try to use. Of course, usually it's so degraded, if it stayed in there, it wouldn't hold water anyway. But
right.
We want to have about at least a 6 mil plastic. A lot of people might double the plastic too per bed. That's really more to guard against a leak. But 6 mil plastic, new plastic. We also want to, after we lay that, put that plastic in, use some kind of greenhouse disinfectant. There's a couple of brands of those. You don't want to use bleach so much in a greenhouse, but just it's called a quaternary ammonium salt. There's one called Fisan that we like to use. There's one called Green Shield, and the rate's about 3 ounces per gallon. So you go in there and spraying down all the open surfaces in this greenhouse. I like to go about up to the height of the curtains on the side, and you don't need to necessarily spray all of the ceiling in there, but just all the open surfaces that might come in contact with these trays and plants. And so usually do that maybe the day before or a couple of days before we start to seed, put the plastic in the beds. A lot of people like to, when they put that water in the bed, they like to do that maybe a few days or at least one day prior. Not sure how much the idea is you're going to warm the water up in there. So it's sitting in there, the sun's out in the greenhouse, that water gets warm. And so I'm not sure if it affects anything about wicking of those trays or germination, but it does, I guess there's some reasoning there that you're putting plants or these trays on warm water instead of cold water, and it
makes them sleep better.
Maybe beneficial, yeah. So that's usually a normal thing people do a day before. Go ahead and fill the bed. It also allows you to have that water in there overnight, at least one night. You can look, and it's not uncommon to get some leaks in these things.
Exactly.
That's right. Aggravating too.
That to me was always the biggest reason to fill it ahead of time, even two or 3 days ahead of time, is you can watch that water level for a day and make sure it's not going to fluctuate on you.
Yeah. Because the worst thing is have that thing full of plants and come in one morning and then sitting on the bottom.
I have done that. I floated trays one evening and the next day they'd be sitting on the plastic.
So. Yeah, I had one do that. It wasn't a leak in the plastic, but I didn't have it stapled good on one side, so it actually
slumped
rolled out underneath my boards and ended up with a pond outside the greenhouse, but a dry float bed inside. Right. So you can have that kind of thing. So it's good to, yeah, for nothing else, I think maybe to check for leaks. And on that, we've had some, on occasion, some faulty plastic that had some leaks in it. They actually make a tape that you can patch if you know where the hole is. That's the hard part. You can actually patch that underwater and it sticks. So it's, but it's just good to make sure you got good plastic. It's not a bad idea to double it in these beds in case you hit a sharp gravel spot or something, and make sure it doesn't leak and warms up some. So that's kind of the starting point. Starting clean, making sure any debris in there before you ever disinfect is swept out, and then getting any dirt out of there that might have been sitting around, blowed in from the last summer. So just starting out with a clean situation. So that brings us to trays and seeding. And so new trays is the easiest thing to do, just kind of like the float water. You know, if you're unsure about those, you can disinfect trays fairly easily, but you never quite get them. They're better the second year disinfected than they are the fourth year disinfected, where we're trying to use a bleach solution. And so trying to get those, it's hard to get in all those little cracks in these styrofoam trays. And so it's
a job, too, to try to disinfect.
Yeah, it's it is. Job. You really need to.
I've done it. It's a job.
You got to cut, and that's another thing. You would have those at a 10% bleach solution, and then you would cover them with plastic overnight and then wash them off the next morning. But it's just easier and more peace of mind for most people just to go ahead and buy new trays.
Yep. You know, since COVID, you know, supply issues and getting the supplies that we need's been an issue for a multitude, from homeowner type things to, you know, to automobiles. But have you heard of any issues with, I mean, is there a backlog in these trays or there's, anything like that that may cause an issue for some of these folks?
Yeah, I was just thinking about that. I hadn't heard issues about trays, but media has been slow to get here. And there's been some shipments come in, but there's been some that's been delayed. Mm-hmm. And so kind of like on these other products that we know there's delays, it's the media so far has been the issue with us. There's some coming. It's not just like we hadn't got any. There's been some coming, but it's been fewer loads come in, and they've been delayed. And so I know at least one big greenhouse grower over in Logan County that was a week later seeding than he had planned to be, just because waiting on
the fuel prices that we've got right now are not going to help anything.
Yeah, you're talking about diesel prices at $4.75 or $5.
Five and a quarter is what I paid on the way up here.
Is that right? Yeah.
Yesterday it was $5.11 down here at Oak Grove. So.
Yeah.
That's going to hurt.
Yep.
Already is hurt.
Yeah.
Make diesel $1.56 again. We'll see that on a cap one these days.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, that's one thing that just like I would tell growers right now to be checking on the sucker control materials, definitely, I mean, they're going to be trying to get it anyway, but hopefully they have checked on their media some weeks ago to see what the schedule is on that. And so everything's behind. I mean, we got one building left at Princeton as far as the tobacco infrastructure. And it had four overhead doors. They all blew out, and I'm trying to get doors replaced. And the first time I ordered doors, it's going to take 26 weeks to get overhead. Wow. These are standard overhead doors, too.
26 weeks.
They aren't anything special, just standard overhead doors. And so it's everything's kind of like that, it seems like, or a lot of things are. And right now with greenhouse, it's the media that's a little bit slow getting here. But you definitely don't want to, if we get in a bind on media, we'd rather not try to use some old media that's been sitting around somewhere, especially last, you know, if it's something from a year or more ago. Even some of the stuff you get fresh, we've had on occasion we get some wicking problems. So this media that we use in tobacco float beds, it's got a wicking agent in it already, so that allows that we float that tray that's got those trays are about an inch and three quarters deep or 2 inches deep, and they have a column of this soilless media. They got a hole in the bottom of each cell. These trays have most of them are 288 cell trays, And so it's the idea is to is that water is going to wick up to the top of that sail where that seed is setting.
Right.
And then that seed's going to start to germinate after that. But some of this, if we get into some older media, that that wicking agent's the first thing that that evaporates off. And so you end up with basically a bag of peat, which is very hydrophobic. It doesn't like water. So it's very hard to get water to go in there without a whole lot of help. And so if there's any question about the, even with the fresh media, if it feels dry, one good remedy for that is if you think there may be, that's another thing I like to do the day before. Just taking, you know, before you see the whole greenhouse, just put, you know, do three or four trays, float them the night before, see how they wick, make sure they're going to wick good. Right. If they seem slow or you got any question, a lot of growers will go ahead and they'll add a quart of water to each bag of media and try to get that stirred up in there best they can. But that, if there's some marginal stuff out there, marginal media, that can be one thing that can head it off.
And do you do that just right before you, I mean, do you need to do that the day before or, you know, 2 hours before? Or can you put it in there and then just start?
Yeah. It doesn't have to be that far ahead of time. It can be the day of your seeding if you're going to do that. You shouldn't have to do that if you got fresh media, but if you're if you floated a few trays the night before, you got fresh media, you know, but they weren't quite as fast as you thought they should be wicking, that's one thing that some growers have done. Worst thing is to get into, there is some things we can, I recommend trying to do if we get some wicking problems. You always have a few dry sails. There's some places that bridge there where the media will bridge in those sails. And some media is worse than others. If it has more fines in it, it tends to have a little more air pockets in it. But for folks that are using a manual gravity box maybe for putting the media in the trays, most people now are automated where it's going through and it's got there's a box that and a conveyor that's pushing those through. But every few trays you want to look under that tray and make sure you're seeing media in the bottom of that hole and not many gaps. And if you think you're seeing some bridging, just a couple of little taps, just take some extra time, but just tapping that tray lightly, not enough to you know, collapse that dibble where it's been dibbled, but just a little tap can seal up that bridge in there. So that's one thing that helps a lot. Some people have gone to thinking about static around new trays, where when you get them out of that plastic sleeve and you put them in that in through the media box there, wondering about if that's got some effect on how they wick. So some people will have a barrel of water and they'll dip those trays. We used to do that every year. We did a test finally after 15. You did a test. Well, does dipping a tray really help? Mm-hmm. You know, we did that right. A couple of years ago. Didn't make a difference at all whether we dipped them or not. At least in that year, you know.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I don't think it really matters on the dipping of the tray. But on the wicking part, if you get in there, you know, it's not uncommon to see even as much as one to three sails per tray that are dry. Obviously, if a sail's dry, there's not going to be a plant there, even if there was a seed there. But if you get into a lot of wicking problems, I've brought them around by misting over the top. We've had growers that actually, there was a grower in Owensboro he had a little water table, he called it, where he would make his trays up with media. And before they went to the cedar, they would run through this little, it was just some flat fan nozzles, about three of them, set up on a little bridge that tray would go through, and it just wet them, you know, and he thought that would help quite a bit. And he may have even done that with the seed in them to help seed break down. Back when we had all these spiral root problems back in the back 15 years ago, he thought that would help with that too. But
when they thought the clay coating was the
issue, clay coating was hard, and so this water table could help that start to break down, you know, before the water got to it from the wicking. But you know, misting over the top, that if it's a mild problem with wicking, that can bring them around. with good media, it can take it might not take 5 minutes for it to wick, and you'll see as soon as you flip that tray, you'll see moisture at the top. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it may take an hour and a half, but you know, still they all wick. It's the same difference. A lot of times the sunlight seems like it. I get faster wicking if I'm seeding on a day when it's cloudy. I'm not sure how to explain this, but when it's cloudy outside, it seems like we get faster wicking than when if it's sunny. Of course, you think about it, if it's sunny, it's more evaporation, which will be pulling water up. We expect more soluble salts in if we get more sunny days. But with wicking, it seems like it on a cloudy day, we get faster results there. But it could take an hour and a half. If it takes more than 3 hours, though, there's probably a problem. So that's why it's good to do this, those few trays early on there. Some growers like, Richard Durham down here, what he used to do, he had a wicking problem 1 year, I guess, and he would they would take a 2x6 board and go down every row, you know, whether it was a wicking problem or not, probably.
Right.
Knowing Richard, he would go to every row down there and, it, you know, just make sure everything wicked. He probably didn't have a single dry cell anywhere when right. he got done. But
pretty conscientious producer all the way
right.
around.
That's right. Absolutely. But they were that's some things that can bring with a mild wicking problem. That's the worst thing is if you get a whole house seeded and all of a sudden only a third of the cell is wicked. I've seen whole houses have to be dumped and redone again. But another good idea to do some just a few trays the night before, day before, to see how they're going to wick there. This floating the trays, checking the wicking. I mentioned misting over the top, that kind of thing. If you get some wicking problems, so you've got your trays seated in there, you got them wicked good, everything looks good. Thinking about temperature control, where to set the temperature. There's a lot of different strategies on where to set temperature in these greenhouses. Ideally, we'd like to see temperature at 72 degrees in these houses. That's ideal for tobacco germination. And so, but some growers will only keep it at 72 or 68 for through germination. You know, germination takes about 9 days on tobacco. And so that's when you can start seeing the first little cotyledon leaves start to come out, that pellet melts, and see a little bit of green about 9 days for most seed sources there. But 72 degrees is ideal. There's also discussion about should you use the circulation fans or not. Most of these greenhouses have cooling fans, of course, which is a big exhaust fan in the end of the greenhouse and a vent opposite that. But then you got circulation fans every 30 or 40 feet on either side of the walkway there. So some growers the idea is think, well, that's really more for when plants get big. I don't want those plants to stay wet very long for disease. So I want that circulation fan. And it's at an angle, at kind of an indirect angle where it's making a circular motion in that greenhouse of air constantly going through there when those fans are on. But they, it's really important to have those early on going too. And a good example of that is, you know, we're seeding now. It's cold. We're going to see some temperatures that are still, this weekend it's going to get down in the 20s on Friday night. And so thinking about that, what those circulation fans also do for you, if they're running while after you seed, is they drive heat to the surface of that tray.
Right. Keep it from rising all to the top of the
yeah.
house.
Of course, heat, you know, hot air rises, and so that's where it ends up at the top. And we did a little study here about 5 years ago in our greenhouse at Princeton where just comparing temperatures from 3 feet above the tray surface compared to the tray surface, if we had the circulation fans running or not. And I was amazed at what we saw, the differences we saw. We were getting 18-degree temperature differences from 3 foot above the tray down to the tray surface if the circulation fan was not on. Circulation fan's on, you never saw more than a 1 degree difference in that. 18-degree, we're going from 70 degrees maybe at 3 foot to 52 there at the tray surface. A huge difference.
Huge difference. First few weeks of life of that plant, that's going to make all the difference in the world. Yeah. And then once that plant starts to get nickel-sized or so, keeping that moisture, you know, much like you would with a larger plant, keeping that moisture away is another reason to keep those fans up and going.
Yeah, that's right.
That's about the time we should start thinking about a control program as far as diseases goes, and looking at different fungicides. So talk a little bit just about fungicide program in a greenhouse.
Yeah. So you've got your plants up, again, 9 days or they'll germinate. And so we look for, at 3 weeks, we want to put our first application of TerraMaster. TerraMaster is the only fungicide that's registered for use in tobacco float beds, in the water under these trays. And so it's excellent against Pythium sulfrot. Pythium sulfrot is the most common float bed disease that we see. And so TerraMaster is excellent on those at 3 weeks. We're going to put that in the water. The rate on TerraMaster is going to be 0.7 ounces to 1 ounce per 100 gallons of water. So, again, the rate on the fertilizer, kind of skipping ahead past fertilizer, we'll come back to fertilizer, is always based on 1,000 gallons of water, but TerraMaster rate is based on 100 gallons. So it's 0.7 ounces to 1 ounce per 100 gallons. So if you got a 3,000 gallon bed, it's going to be 30 ounces of TerraMaster, almost a quarter TerraMaster in that. And so we do that at 3 weeks. And then I generally, if you got new trays and you're clean, a lot of times one application of TerraMaster can get you through the whole season. Sometimes we have to add another shot in there. Maybe you can come in at 3 weeks after the first one and do that again. So that would be at 6 weeks. You can even do it a third time, getting into 7 and 8 weeks after seeding. But TerraMaster helps with main thing is Pythium and also algae. So algae can be a problem. When the biggest thing that happens with that is it's really associated with nitrogen, that's unused nitrogen in the water and in those trays. And so a lot of times people, just for ease of distribution, will put their fertilizer in before they ever float any trays. As they're getting that water ready, they're going to put the fertilizer in. Then when they got open water, you feel like, well, that's the best time I can get it to distributed the best, as opposed to trying to put something under the trays after they're there. But that's a lot of times can give us some problems doing it right then. I like to wait at least a week and even 10 days after seeding to put my fertilizer in, that first shot of fertilizer. Just the media, the nutrients in that media, there's plenty of fortification in that nutrients in there to get us through germination. We shouldn't have to fertilize right off the bat. Normally, if you're fertilizing right then at the beginning, at the time of seeding, you're going to get a lot of algae. You may get some soluble salts injury too if there's a lot of sunny days in that first week or two. So soluble salts, they're going to collect on that cell surface when that plant germinates out of that pellet, and those first little tender leaves touch that really salty surface there. They can just get burnt. So you'll see these little marginal surface burns on there, and you can get some plant loss too on plants that size that are that small. And so that's a big benefit of waiting. Just give it 7 days, 10 days even is a good time to put your fertilizer in. When we do that, what I've got, and a lot of growers have some sort of injection system, I've just got a simple PVC system where it goes, I've got a coupler out to the walkway you can hook a hose onto. And then under those float beds, before we ever put the water in there, it's a branching 3/4-inch PVC pipe that branches off in about 6 directions there. And it's got holes every 18 inches or so to where we put that in, and it's going to distribute through the bottom of that bed. I do that for TerraMaster and fertilizer, and so that's a good way to get that distributed through there. And so, that's about the time we like to do that. And then you would come in at about 3 weeks with your TerraMaster. When we get into 4 or 5 weeks, that's when we start into our first clipping. And so when we start clipping, I like to – you can start spraying manzate fungicide a lot earlier than we do. I like to wait till we start clipping, really. You can start when they're dime-sized. But really, once plants get big enough where – they're covering all the cell surface, and you're clipping those first little buzz cut of these plants, that's when I like to start spraying. So I will spray, like to spray once a week with Manzate fungicide. That's about the only fungicide. Besides, we can do Quadris one time in the float beds, but Manzate we could do weekly. We can use Orthene in there also if you have any problem with cutworms. That's about it for us. What we can use in these float beds is TerraMaster under the plants, Manzate, and Orthene on top, and one application of Quadris in there. So that usually the Quadris will come in usually between the second and third clipping, maybe at about 6 weeks after seeding, maybe 2 weeks before they're ready to go to the field.
And you really need to really pay attention to these trays and plants, Andy, and kind of speak to that a little bit of how, you know, you need to be looking at these things probably, what, every day or every day and a half or something to kind of keep some of this stuff down and stay ahead of it.
That's right. I mean, I like to look at ours twice a day and just like, you know, checking a dark-fired barn. You usually do that at least twice a day. But there's some – well, the biggest thing is, of course, you need to be in there, you know, twice a day getting your curtains up and down if you don't have some kind of automated curtains. That's another thing, too. We've also, on the other side of that, talking about warm air to the plant surface, we'd also like to, you know – heat. We've had some problems with houses getting too hot too. So it's we've got some that getting those curtains down by 10 o'clock in the morning on a sunny day is essential. Making sure your exhaust fan's working. Sometimes those belt breaks or something, the house can get hot. I've seen some that got probably upwards of over 120 degrees and the plants just basically cooked in there.
And you know, so, in the early days of greenhouses, that was one of the hardest messages to get across to a producer, especially if they were new to greenhouses in general. Mm-hmm. Temperature management is not just a seasonal thing. It can very well be a daily thing. We may mm-hmm. be worried about it being too cool in the morning, but it mm-hmm. could very well get too hot in the afternoon. Absolutely. With some of these April days like we have mm-hmm. them.
That's right. So, and so it's trying to keep it not above on a hot day, sunny day, hopefully you got double layer plastic. That helps. That's another thing that we've compared single layer to double layer. That makes a huge difference. You can take a day that's a sunny day that never gets over 45 degrees with a single layer of plastic or two layers that are stuck together. You know, it's no insulation, basically, and that house can get 100 degrees even with the exhaust fan working.
And so, that's really what that air pocket is between those two layers, is it's a form mm-hmm. of insulation. It keeps that outer layer from touching the inner layer, and you're mm-hmm. not going to get energy transfer quite as efficiently.
That's exactly. So it's trying to keep the house not above 95, and then trying to keep it at least, you know, even after germination, when you got four leaves on that plant, it's a lot less sensitive to getting cold type injury. So burley tobacco, I don't know if I've ever grown burley tobacco without getting a little bit of cold injury on it. It always grows out. But dark tobacco is not as sensitive to chill injury, cold injury. That's the kind of the crinkle leaves that you'll see. Your temperature control is a big, keeping it warm enough and not too hot.
Sounds good. Well, we appreciate you coming in this week and talking with us about greenhouse production. We do want to end things up with our timely tip, which this week's timely tip is just making sure folks take a look at their sucker control options that they're typically using and evaluate and find out whether those products are going to be available or not. You talked to us last week in an in-service about certain products because they were not made last year because of factory shutdowns and whatnot during the pandemic, that there's not going to be any available of certain products. So if you don't mind just touching on that just a little bit and
sure will.
Letting folks know.
Yeah, we got word back here about 6 weeks ago that UPL, which is the company that that makes products Butrilin, Offshoot T, Royal Tac M, and Royal MH30, they are out of the sucker control business, at least for now. I'm not sure if they're going to come back. But at least for now, UPL is out of the sucker control business. And so those products are not going to be manufactured this year. There may be some of those still in the pipeline, existing stocks left from last year, but that's all that's out there. They're not going to make that. And so growers need to right now need to be checking with their dealer just to let them know how much sucker control they're going to need. We have seen, as of last week, some pretty sizable increases in contract volumes for dark tobacco, at least from one company. And so there's going to be more of those products required. I spoke with Drexel Chemical this morning, and they assure me that they think they can fill this gap that UPL is going to leave by not having those products out there. Now, they don't make butrolin. A lot of people really like butrolin, but it's going to be a flumetrolin market now, which is Prime Plus. Drexel has their version of Prime Plus called Drexelin Plus, and that's going to be, unless you can get a hold of some old butrolin that's left from last year, this is going to be mostly a Prime Plus is what you're going to have available. A lot of people don't like the Prime Plus because of soil carryover, but trying to be careful about how much you put per plant, not dousing that plant like a lot of folks do.
Like we used to.
Like we used to.
If you pull very many suckers, you'd be glad to douse it.
That's right. That's right.
I was going to say, I think that's just a knee-jerk reaction sometimes.
Try to do all you can to keep that tobacco straight if it means some extra cultivation and ridging where you won't, you know, be encouraged to use so much when you got a crooked stalk.
Right.
But, yeah, those products there are not going to be around. But, yeah, Drexel Chemical, Fair Products is another one that's going to be probably trying to help fill this gap. I'm not sure what the market share was. UPL may have had a third of our market out here or more.
In West Kentucky, I would have thought that would have been one of the heavier products used. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a lot of butrolin. We use quite a bit of it ourselves there, but that one's right now, it's off the table, may not be coming back. So you need to be, just like with your fertilizer, need to be sourcing those, at least telling your dealer what you're going to need. That way, so Drexel's telling me, go ahead and have growers tell their dealer what they're going to need, and then their dealer can communicate that to Drexel,
right.
And that can help them with their manufacturing process in Memphis.
Sounds good. Well, as soon as I heard that last week in our in-service, I knew that's something we'd want to touch on this week. It's not the time of the year to be thinking about sucker control necessarily, but it's definitely, just like every other product, things are going to be more expensive and they're going to be harder to get a hold of. So,
and if you get down to the point that you're ready for sucker control and you hadn't talked to somebody, you're going to wish you had.
That's right.
Well, I mean, it's like we've talked about several times. I mean, you know, this pre-planning is it's just part of it now. I mean, you know, you just have to start earlier doing planning for anything you get ready to do.
Absolutely. So,
and I want to tell folks too, Andy, we're going to get Andy to come back sometime and talk about dark fire tobacco, because this 24 county area that he kind of runs is kind of, this is the dark tobacco capital of the world, fire tobacco capital of the world. So we want to get you back on sometime, Andy, and talk about that.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's a unique production process for sure, but unique to our area, David. Yep. It's a culture.
It is.
And that's we may have to look into having some other guests talk about that culture at some time or another. Man. But
that'd be great.
We're glad, Andy, that you were able to join us today. We appreciate you coming in. I'm also thinking, David, we might want to have him back on a little later in the year when we start talking about, you know, transplanting into the field and then maybe production throughout the process.
So absolutely.
Definitely great information. So
happy to do it.
We want to thank you for joining us. We want to thank Andy and thank our host for this week's information, and thanks to our listeners for joining in. We hope you've enjoyed our show, and we'll make plans to join us again next week for our next episode. And until then, remember, Kentucky Ag matters.